This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Horace Kephart wrote that he owed his life to the Great Smoky Mountains. The naturalist and writer spent years fighting to preserve the mountains so others could benefit from them as well. In addition to his crusade for the Smokies, Kephart is known for his writing. He wrote a book called Camping and Woodcraft. It's still referred to today as the Camper's Bible. A new biography of Kephart details his contributions to the world of the outdoors and his first career as a librarian. George Ellison and Janet McHugh are the co-authors of Back of Beyond, a Horace Kephart biography. George is a naturalist and writer. Janet is an independent writer and researcher. She's also former director of the Mann Library at Cornell University, and both join us now. George, Janet, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Good to have you here. George, talk about those who do know Horace Kephart at all, many know him from his writings. Talk about the way he wrote about the natural world and some of the writing that he's left with us.
Yeah, he was more of an outdoorsman, I think, Frank, than a naturalist per se. He didn't collect butterflies or that sort of thing. He was interested in the practical things that you could do outside, how to make a campfire. He has 10 pages in his book on how to walk. And there was only one way to do things, Frank, and that was the Kephart way. He was confident in his work outside. And
well, how does one walk in the woods the Kephart way?
Well, you make sure you lift your feet and step forward, and let the outside of your foot behind the little toe hit first, and then you stride forward with a bouncing gait that will carry you wherever you want to go.
That's amazing. How much of that was because that's going to keep you going a little bit longer? It's better for your feet, better for your stamina. And how much of that is better for the trail and the treadway itself? How much was he paying attention to that kind of thing, too?
No, I don't think so. But that, on that level, he was paying attention to it on a macro level and what would happen to the mountains per se.
Yeah.
And his devotion to the idea that you just read about, he threw his whole life into helping to save the mountains and create the Great Smoky Mountains National Park.
Well, Jana, tell us a little bit about how he did that and talk about his fight for the Smokies.
You know, I think Kephart saw the mountains as saving his life. And you know, just as you quoted and George quoted, and you know, I think it's I see Kephart's largest contribution conveying the idea of a national park in the Smokies. You know, I think rightly so, no one person is ever credited with founding the Great Smoky Mountains. It was a collaborative affair. It took, you know, politicians and civic leaders and conservationists and, you know, school children contributing pennies and foundations contributing millions to actually make the Smokies into a national park. But, you know, Kephart's writings and his advocacy for the Smokies are, I think, his major contribution.
Yeah, and I realize I failed to place him in time here, but we're talking about somebody who's getting going around the turn of the 20th century before there is a national park system,
mm-hmm.
Right, Janet?
Right, right. You know, and I think there was a confluence of there had been attempts earlier to protect the Smokies, but there was no National Park Service until 1916. You know, Stephen Mather didn't come out with a statement saying, I think we should have some parks in the east as well as some parks in the west. I mean, those were, you know, precipitating comments that that allowed, or commitments that allowed the Smokies to, you know, the idea of protecting this park to come to fruition. So it was... Kephart's, he wrote a letter in 1920 saying, you know, he can't imagine being able to protect the Smokies. The timbering interests were too powerful a force. The land was too expensive for the government to buy. But, you know, a few years later, he was as optimistic as anyone and seeing the opportunity to protect the Smokies.
Well, George, what happened? What changed in that time? I know that Kephart stayed with it, even though the odds seemed to be against him. But how was he able to marshal? I mean, Jana talked about the fact that lots of people,
yeah,
bunnies at a time, got involved. Tell us more about his success and how it all, and the success of all of those. But it was one that a fight that he led, certainly.
Right. Well, he had, by that time, we're talking mainly, Frank, about the 1920s. That's when the park movement really got started. There had been notions of it prior to that, but the 1920s. By that time, Kephart had a national reputation. He had written Our Southern Highlanders, which was immediately recognized as a classic study of the Southern Mountains. As we mentioned, he wrote Camping Woodcraft, which was published in 1907, the first edition. And then by the time the park movement started, he joined forces with a Japanese photographer named George Masa. And together with Kephart's writing, his national reputation, and the wonderful photography of George Masa, to help carry the day. And Kephart was savvy enough not to stress the value of the park strictly in an environmental sense, but also in an economic sense, what it would bring to the mountains in terms of money, to put it frankly.
Yeah, but you had you had to sort of generate some concern about the people in the mountains in order for that to be an argument. So tell us more about Our Southern Highlanders and what that book was and why it was so well received.
Okay. Kephart, before his life fell apart in part due to alcoholism, and he came to the Smokies in 1904, seeking for a place where he can start all over again. And it strikes a bell with anyone who reads it. Could I read you, Frank, a 10-line excerpt?
Sure.
From Our Southern Highlanders?
Sure, that'd be great.
Yeah. And this is from the second chapter, which is titled The Back of Beyond. When I went south into the mountains, I was seeking a back of beyond. This for more reasons than one. With an inborn taste for the wild and romantic, I yearned for a strange land and a people that had the charm of originality. Again, I had a passion for early American history, and in far Appalachia, it seemed that I might realize the past and the present, seeing with my own eyes what life must have been to my pioneer ancestors of a century or two ago. Besides, I wanted to enjoy a free life in the open air, the thrill of exploring new ground, the joys of the chase, and the man's game of matching my woodcraft against the forces of nature with no help from servants or hired guides. In our primitive community, there were no trades, no professions. Every man was his own farmer, blacksmith, gunsmith, carpenter, cobbler, miller, tinker. Someone in his family or near neighbor served him as barber or dentist, and they would make him a coffin when he died. So that sort of vigorous writing appealed to many people, and still does. People enjoy it to this day.
Well, that was George Ellison reading from Horace Kephart's book, Our Southern Highlanders. George and Janet McHugh are authors of Back of Beyond, a Horace Kephart biography. And Janet, before even he became an outdoorsman, he had a life as a librarian. Tell us about his time as a librarian in St. Louis.
Well, actually, you know, he became a librarian here. I'm in upstate New York, and he trained as a librarian here at Cornell University when he was a grad student. He was studying history and political science. And he went to, after 2 years of grad school, he went to Italy with his mentor, Willard Fisk, and studied and researched and collected books and manuscripts for Willard Fisk, who was an incredible bibliographer and bibliophile, who later bequeathed his collections of Petrarch and Dante and Icelandic literature to Cornell. But after a year in Europe, Kephart was lonely for his sweetheart. He had fallen in love with a woman named Laura, And so on Valentine's Day, on her birthday, after a year abroad, he came back, and he began looking for a job. His first job was at Yale. And there he spent 3 years as a librarian. And then he was offered the director of the St. Louis Mercantile Library in St. Louis. And, you know, front page headlines heralded his arrival. He modernized and expanded the library. Today, the director of the St. Louis Public Library, or the director of the St. Louis Mercantile Library, John Hoover, said that he was a great Americanist and that the collections that Kephart developed there, particularly the Frontier Histories, were just extraordinary finds. And he thought that he was prescient in being able to, in developing that kind of collection, prescient in the sense that he would guess that future scholars would find them very interesting because they were tales of the ordinary Americans. And I think that that comes true in, you know, in Kephart's Our Southern Highlanders as well. You know, he enjoys the stories of people who aren't necessarily the famous, the wealthy, but instead the explorers and the, and you know, in this case, the what he was collecting in St. Louis were the frontier histories.
What an expansive view of preserving American history, not only the text, the stories, as you say, even the stories of ordinary Americans, which was not a common notion at that time, that this was something we would preserve, not around the turn of the 20th century. It's getting more popular
right.
these days.
Completely right.
But also then realizing that saving the landscape on which they tread would also be an important thing, that we need to put it in a library and also make sure that the land they walked on is preserved as well. And that's enormous capacity, it seems to me, for one human being. But also, and let's get to this part of the story, it may never have gotten to that. George, you referred to his alcoholism. He was having some pretty hard times before he made it to the Smokies, right? Tell us about his life immediately prior to his coming to the Smokies.
Yeah, let me start off with it, and then maybe Janet will want to chime in. That's a technical part of the story. But he was recognized nationally as a librarian up until the mid-50s when he began to take the late 1890s, 1890s, he began to make long ventures into the backcountry around St. Louis, camping for days, not telling Laura where he was going or when he was going to come back. And then the board of directors of the library told him in those uncertain terms that we can't run the library in this system. In this manner. And he couldn't get off the track he was on. Alcoholism was a main factor in it. There were doubtless other psychological reasons. But part of it was he and his father had, through the years, romanticized the pioneer way of life, that lifestyle. And Kephart had a great infatuation with anything having to do with those things. And so when he lost his job in 1903, by the turn of the century, he was had looking for a place back or beyond, which would plug in to the excerpt I just read to you. When I went south into the mountains, I was seeking a back or beyond.
Yeah, and Jana, tell us more about this unraveling, because he really was suffering deeply, insomnia, and there was even a suicide letter. Tell us more about that.
Right, right. You know, in the same way that the front page headlines announced Kephart's arrival as director of the St. Louis Mercantile Library, front page headlines in the St. Louis newspapers detailed every single painful aspect of Kephart's fall from grace. You know, Kephart is a very private man, and yet the full text of his suicide note was in the front page paper. The one reporter came into his hospital room when he was stopped from this, his suicide attempt to jump off the Eads Bridge in St. Louis. A policeman stopped him and took him to the emergency room. But a reporter came into Kephart's room and recorded this extraordinary conversation that he had with a man who was having psychotic episodes, who imagined the birds calling his name, who had shot through the roof of the hunting lodge that he had been in a few days previous. I mean, there were extraordinary details of a man who was, whose life was collapsing. His parents and Laura came back to St. Louis. Laura, when Kephart lost his job in 1903, when he was asked to resign because of his repeated and extended absences from the library, Laura and his six children, we haven't mentioned that he had a family yet, but there were six children, two boys and four girls, and they all went back to Ithaca, where Laura's family was, Ithaca, New York. Obviously, there was no income coming into the family. She needed to take care of these six children. But anyway, Laura came back when he was in the hospital, as did his father. And his father took him back to Dayton, Ohio, where he recovered. And 2 months later, there was a notice in the library journal saying that, you know, he'd recovered fully, and newspaper reports were much exaggerated.
And it was his father who
recommended. Exaggerated, but.
But it was his father then who recommended that he go to the mountains and find himself.
Well, yes, I'll break in there. He described that part of the story as his father, Isaiah, who was quite a man, was a co-conspirator in the quixotic search for back and beyond.
Yeah. And Jana, what were you going to add?
No, I was going to say something similar. I think it was a mutual thing. I mean, Kephart's one of his heroes in terms of camping and woodcraft was Nesmuk, George Washington Sears. Nesmuk was his pen name, and Nesmuk also saw the woods as a recuperative place, and Kephart certainly believed that, and that was not at all uncommon. You know, at the time, to feel like the stress of industrial America was wreaking havoc on people, and that an escape into the woods was recuperative. That same kind of thinking is being researched right now by people like Bratman or in books like The Nature Fix, you know, being able to go into the woods to recover that sense of balance. And I certainly think that Kephart had that. And just as George says, he also saw that the romantic idea of a frontier existence, but paring his life out of this, you know, paring stress out of his life was very much a part of his quest to get into the woods.
And some of that woods included Bryson City, where he found himself, Bryson City, North Carolina. George, where you live, why did he decide to come to North Carolina?
Well, he and his father looked at eastern Virginia as a possibility, and also down in parts of Kentucky. But they found a big, wide space on a map that indicated very few people lived there, and they picked the Great Smokies region, and he just took off in summer of 1904, caught the train from Dayton to Asheville, caught the train from Asheville to Dillsboro, where Silver's located, got off the train, walked over, pitched his tent on Dix Creek, and by the fall of 1904, he had settled back in the Smokies, in on the area what's known as the Little Fork of the Sugar Fork of Hazel Creek.
Well, if anybody wants to find out more, they're going to have to read your book, Back of Beyond, a Horace Kephart story, written by George Ellison and Janet McHugh, my guests today on The State of Things. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Back of Beyond, a Horace Kephart biography. Janet, an independent writer and researcher, also former director of the Mann Library at Cornell University. George, a naturalist and writer. They're going to be at Blue Ridge Books in Waynesville tomorrow at 3 o'clock, and you can find out details at our website, stateofthings.org. The music of Ms. Connie B. is just ahead. Stay with us.